Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. In each legislative session, Wisconsin lawmakers review hundreds of proposals, each of which, if passed, could have significant impact on residents throughout central and northern Wisconsin. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. The Wisconsin State Legislature runs a robust website, but it can be challenging to sift through all the information that's available online. The focus of the fall session has ranged from managing chronic wasting disease in our deer population to ensuring mental health care is readily available for residents. Joining us today are two Wisconsin lawmakers, Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point, who represents the 71st Assembly District. Katrina, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also joining us is Republican State Representative Pat Snyder of Schofield, representing the 85th Assembly District. Thank you for being here, Pat.
Thank you, Shereen.
So this is your chance to hear from local lawmakers and your chance to ask questions as well. You can join the conversation by calling 800-780-9745. I know there have been a range of subjects being discussed by lawmakers right now in the most recent session, but I'd like to start by asking each of you, what's the most challenging part of your job?
Go ahead, Katrina.
That's a great question. I think for me, I love the opportunity to serve and the opportunity to help solve problems and improve people's lives every day. And the biggest challenge for me is that there's not enough time in a day to do everything that people ask for. And if I could work 24 hours a day, I think I would. But we're all human beings. So at the end of the day, you know, you get so many requests. And I always joke with my staff when I meet with them every week, I've got another bill idea. It's because our constituents, our community members across Wisconsin are so brilliant and informed and engaged and active and inspiring. And I just want to do as much as possible for them. So that's the challenge.
All right. Pat, what about you?
I think the most difficult thing is that we get ideas, you know, and we work with our fellow legislators, both sides of the aisle. We get it rolling and get things on, and then it will suddenly stop, and the momentum goes. And that's the frustrating thing of if we get it passed in the assembly to suddenly have it stall out in the Senate. And I've just got my second term now. I'm realizing that, okay, there's legislative pace and the methods you need to try to get allies to be able to get things done. But like Katrina, I do rely a lot on the people and the input in my district to come up with ideas for bills and also to try to help them.
So generally speaking, which are some of the bills that passed in the fall session that you see as having the biggest impact on your constituents, especially in the time since the budget passed? Katrina, how about you?
Sure. So, you know, I'll be honest, we've only had a couple dozen bills pass and get signed into law this session, and that's an unfortunate reality at a time when I think the people of Wisconsin are asking us to do as much as possible to reach across the aisle and get things done for them, whether it's improving healthcare affordability, clean water, good schools, more broadband access, et cetera. There are a couple bills that I would highlight in the fall session. One was, in the assembly at least, we passed legislation to expand access to birth control over the counter, which I strongly supported. I actually have a birth control bill that would allow people to get 12 months of birth control up front at the pharmacy as well. And I thought this is a good first step to improving access to reproductive health care. Another bill that I think we might talk about is the hemp 2.0. And that's we have a lot of hemp farmers who I specifically had some in central Wisconsin who got burn notices, and we can talk at length about the difficulty of not having enough DACAP staff on the ground and what happens when you're at above 0.3%, but you lose your whole crop. And I think this bill will actually help by providing people more options for how they can process it into CBD oil down the road and not have to essentially take a $10, $20, $30, even $50,000 hit or more, depending on, you know, what size you're growing at and where you're at in terms of testing. So those were two bills that we passed on a bipartisan basis that I thought would improve people's lives and make a difference.
All right. What about you, Pat? What do you think is going to have the most impact?
Well, and like Katrina said, we haven't had a lot of bills that were, you know, passed by both houses and then signed by the governor. The one that they haven't been through yet that I think will have an impact that maybe haven't passed are the homelessness bills. I mean, we got them through the assembly. It's something that the governor talked about in his budget. We put them out there. We got all through the assembly, and they haven't had a hearing yet in the Senate. Mm-hmm. So that's a little discouraging, and I think that would help a lot of folks, especially when it comes to the housing. You know, the bill that I was able to author, you know, the $1.2 million a year added to the housing, emergency housing, and for not only families but individuals. You know, that's important to, you know, try to get this group of individuals started to get back on their feet and move forward. So I think hopefully the more important stuff coming up will be before we end session in April, that we with the task force we have, the water task force mm-hmm. that Katrina was vice chair on. I was on the adoption task force and also the suicide task force. If we can get some of those bills through, I think that'll be very important.
Okay. Earlier this month, the state assembly refused to consider a bill that would stiffen penalties for repeat drunken drivers. Now, this is something that has been brought up time and time again. Of course, there have been some changes in laws in recent years, but this particular bill would have increased the minimum time in prison for a fifth or sixth OWI from 6 months to 18 months. The Senate passed the bill. The Assembly did not. So what do you think? Why are efforts to stiffen OWI penalties so tough to pass in Wisconsin? Pat, maybe you want to start?
Well, I know that our colleagues on the other side wanted to have funding available for treatment added to this. And the fiscal part of it, if we return, I don't know if that would get through the Senate again, because they pretty much made it clear that they think the budget was where we spend the money and we don't add more. Otherwise, I don't know. I just think it's something about the culture of Wisconsin. For you know, and it's maybe not as much legislators as it is people. I don't know. Katrina, you've been here all your life as well. If we somehow, you know, try to not pay enough attention to it, but 18 months after your fifth or sixth offense, I think most people would, you know, you look at some of the other states and it's a lot more stiff. But mm-hmm. when it comes to Wisconsin, you know, and you even get conversations going like, you want a drink? And I said, well, no, I don't drink. Well, then have a beer. You know, mm-hmm. they don't even think beer maybe right. is alcohol. So it might be the mindset of the people, but it is a tough hurdle to get people convinced that we need to get a little tougher.
I just want to break in for a moment and share something. I was in Florida for a journalism conference over the last few days, and I was with a group of journalists from all over the country and from out of the country, from Chile, from Hong Kong, from New York, from Baltimore. And we were talking about the drunk driving laws in Wisconsin, and when I said that first-time offenses aren't treated as a criminal offense, their jaws dropped. That was unthinkable to them. So it's interesting that you brought up the cultural aspect of this, because the thinking in some of the other areas seems to be clearly different. So sorry, and Katrina, I apologize. I know that you wanted to jump in on this issue, and I just wanted to share that because I think that it's interesting to look at what other people in other states see when they look at these issues.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really important that when we incarcerate people for an issue like alcoholism, that we're making sure we're not contributing to recidivism and basically putting them in jail, letting them out, and then they go ahead and reoffend. You know, if we're not reducing recidivism at the same time, then the punishment doesn't actually fit, because all we're doing is paying for them to come back to jail or prison again, right? So I think it's really important that we invest in treatment alternatives and diversion. Portage County has had a great alcohol and drug court. We call it a treatment court, that's been incredibly successful. It saves thousands, tens of thousands of dollars on every year for taxpayers, but it also reduces recidivism. I don't think anyone feels comfortable with the idea of somebody going to prison or jail for a drunk driving offense, multiple drunk driving offenses, getting out, going to the bar, and then driving home. And that's exactly what can happen right now. So if we're not treating the problem, the root of the problem, I do think what we're essentially doing is footing taxpayers with a larger bill down the road, and we're also being cavalier with people's lives. You know, I think treatment is incredibly important. It's a huge part of the discussion that we need to have, and it's also a cultural issue that we need to take a look at when we talk about drunk driving.
All right. Let's talk about snowmobiling, too. And this is another alcohol-related question. I see the Assembly is considering a bill that would establish a penalty for snowmobile drivers younger than 21 who consume alcohol. I was a little surprised to see that the current anti-sobriety requirement only applies for snowmobile drivers younger than 19. So what are your thoughts on that? And why was the age 19 when the drinking age was 21? I don't know who can best answer that question.
Katrina, do you know?
I don't know, but if I were to assume, I would say that must be an old statute rooted right. in when, you know, the drinking age was 18, and it just must be some kind of disparity between the laws. And that's, you know, frankly, a lot of what we do in the legislature is look at how our statutes conflict with each other and try to update the law. So I assume it's one of those.
Yeah, I agree with Katrina. I just think it was something that wasn't looked at earlier and needed to be changed and just to move it up in compliance with everything else.
Again, I want to invite our listeners to call in if you have questions for our guests. 800-780-9742 is the number to call. Hunting, too, of course, hunting season about to get underway here in central and, well, in Wisconsin as a whole. Of course, this is another big issue for residents in our region. Katrina, you co-authored some proposals related to chronic wasting disease. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I've been meeting with the DNR for the past 6 months or so before I introduced this legislation called the Healthy Herd, Healthy Hunt Package. And what this is about is ensuring our state's deer herd is healthy. CWD tests results have gone up almost every single year over the past decade. And I'm very concerned about the trend of the number of deer that are testing for CWD. So while our testing has gone up in the last couple years, it was pretty stagnant for a while. So the package includes three bills, one of which is increasing access to testing kiosks by funding them across the state so that we can get more CWD tests going and people can understand exactly where the trajectory is for CWD. And then also carcass dumps. It's incredibly important that you dispose of your deer carcass the right way. Those prions can actually move through, water, soil, and that is one of the ways in which it can infect other wildlife. So I think it's very important that we properly manage the carcasses and getting them in those dumpsters, since not every landfill will accept those carcasses, is incredibly important. So that bill funds more carcass dumpsters across the state. And then finally, I took a look at the funding levels for CWD research and management over the last few budgets, and it really has gone downhill. So I have a new bill to fund research and management of CWD in Wisconsin. And I worked with the DNR to put these proposals out and reached out to my colleagues in both parties and asked them to help. I think it's really important that we recognize hunting isn't just part of our cultural heritage and traditions. It's a really exciting time for folks across the state. It's a huge boon to our economy. It's about a $1 billion industry in Wisconsin. So I wish everyone the best of luck this weekend. I hope the weather cools down a little bit for them so they have ideal temperatures. And I am excited for everyone to go hunting, but I also think we have more work to do when it comes to managing CWD, and I'm hopeful we can have a conversation. I am asking this week the chair of the Sporting Heritage Committee in the Assembly to hold a public hearing on these bills.
Pat, what are you hearing from your constituents about this issue?
It's kind of been under the radar, but I've heard from other individuals, especially on the environmental side and the hunters, saying that, hey, this is a problem that's under the radar that no one's talking about, that's only growing. So I applaud Representative Shanklin's efforts to be able to maybe get this out there, and knowing Representative Stanchult of the committee and as much of a hunter he is, I hope he does take up an informational hearing and see if there's ways we can get some ways to stop this and not hurt the hunting and move forward on that, because I know I was talking to some folks over by Marathon and they said it's pretty high over there as well, CWD, and I just didn't realize it was in even Marathon County. So I think knowledge is the one thing a lot of folks don't maybe know about it, so they don't talk about it, except for the hunters.
Well, we do have a lot more to talk about. Democratic State Representative Katrina Shanklin of Stevens Point and Republican State Representative Pat Snyder of Schofield are our guests today on Route 51. And we will continue our local legislative roundup in a moment. You can join the conversation, too, at 800-780-9742. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Republican State Representative Pat Snyder of Schofield and Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point are in the studio today as we discuss recent and upcoming legislation being proposed in Madison. This is your chance to ask questions. We'd love to hear from you. What issues matter most? The number to call is 800-780-9742. I'd like to start this next segment by talking a little bit about medical marijuana. Public opinion at an all-time high. If you look at the polls and you believe those polls, 80% of respondents in the most recent Marquette University poll are saying that they approve of legalizing medical marijuana. There appears to be bipartisan support for this. So why isn't it gaining any traction, and what do you think the future is for this in Wisconsin?
Well, I am very proud to be one of the lead co-authors of this legislation once again, and this is the fourth time I've co-sponsored it. I think it's incredibly important that we recognize for too long people have not had access to the benefits of medical marijuana. And I have heard from terminal cancer patients, people who suffer from chronic pain, people who have PTSD, who've described the benefits of marijuana to them, and who many times are using it right now illegally, and they recognize that, and they say, listen, if the government wants to come and prosecute me for trying to seek a way to relieve my pain as a terminal cancer patient, then so be it, and maybe it will finally force them to legalize. I think it's important to note that yesterday, a key congressional committee took a very important first step to vote to deschedule marijuana as a Schedule I drug, and I think that's a really historic step, and I'm looking forward to the federal conversation. But the benefits, whether for those who suffer from epilepsy or have glaucoma, chronic pain, there are clear benefits to medical marijuana. 33 other states have already done so. Wisconsin is an island right now when it comes to the Midwest and our marijuana policies. And I believe at a bare minimum, we should be legalizing medical marijuana and taking steps forward beyond that, like decriminalization and getting us on a stronger path. So I think it's an issue related to quality of life more than anything else.
Pat, what are you hearing about this?
I hear similar to what Katrina just mentioned, and I definitely in support. You know, you had the resolution here in Marathon County. 81%, I believe, wanted the passage of legalization of medical marijuana. And I've talked to a lot of people that, you know, are veterans with a PTSD, a woman who lives outside the Athens area that has MS, that maybe can't get back to work but can function in her home with the aid of this. I think it could be done. I know the state of Minnesota has done a nice job. I know that right now there is legislation that is coming up utilizing some of the things that Minnesota's done and some of the others with proper regulation, you know, when it comes to, you know, the pill, ointment, drops, things to that nature, how it's produced, things to that nature. Doctors don't want to be the ones prescribing it. Mm-hmm. They want, you know, maybe to come up with the areas where, you know, it's recommended, but they don't want to be the middle person coming forward saying, yes, you have this, go and get this marijuana. They just, you know, they want that you have this MS, you have terminal cancer, you know, you're eligible for this, and then you go and go and pick it up.
Right.
And so it's regulated, and that's what Minnesota's done.
Five years ago.
Yeah. And there's no push for recreational over there. No. And, again, Illinois is, you know, the Wild West, and December 1st, Michigan turns into the Wild West, which we'll see a little bit more of. And eventually maybe the feds will come through and the whole thing. But right now I would support, and I know there's very close to some other legislation coming through with a little bit different regulations that I'm looking at that I think I could definitely support.
Is this going to happen, though? I mean, we hear about it a lot. We hear a lot of talk about it, but nothing moves forward on it.
I believe it's going to get through the assembly.
Well, I'm hopeful. We haven't taken a vote on medical marijuana yet, and the speaker continues to say, well, he'll look at it, he'll look at it. I think it's incumbent on every elected official to recognize that the legislature is far behind public opinion, regardless of how you identify, if you're a Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Green, Independent. overwhelmingly, people support access to medical marijuana, and public opinion is shifting pretty strongly on legalization fully as well.
Right.
And I think people need to recognize, as elected officials, it's our job to listen to the people and to act instead of dragging our feet. And that's what's been most frustrating about this. I welcome the conversation. I know the Assembly did take the lead on passing legislation that first legalized CBD oil, but it also added a lot of hurdles, I'll say. And until we passed a trailer bill to kind of rectify the situation, I had so many businesses who were asking me, can we even legally sell this? And then finally, the federal farm bill made it clear that they could. But I do want to challenge all of my colleagues in the legislature to listen to the people on this issue and on every issue. It is very clear to us every referendum across the state regarding legalizing medical marijuana and recreational marijuana passed. So we clearly need to be putting Wisconsin on a path. And my suggestion would be, listen, if this is too complicated to do with just several competing bills through the legislature, then we should have a bipartisan task force comprised of experts in the field on this issue so that we can take a look at how best to craft legislation that could get through both houses and have the governor sign by the end of session.
Well, I definitely in favor of the medical marijuana, but you know, the good news that Representative Shanklin mentioned about the feds maybe thinking about descheduling, I think will help me and others in our thoughts about recreational marijuana because of the effects it has on brains. You know, I don't know if alcohol could get through today if it was being introduced for the first time with the things, and especially when it comes to the brain of the youth. And so I would like to see more studies done, and I think descheduling it would allow that, and then we'd get a full medical analysis of what the benefits are. Because, you know, we talk about how bad of a situation we have with alcohol. You know, and many sheriffs have told me we'd just be adding more to it for the whole recreational side of things. But I did hear that they do think they'll have a piece of equipment that will be able to measure THC with a breathalyzer by next year.
That is a significant issue that has been brought forward by law enforcement, the inability to be able to measure that the same way that they do alcohol behind the wheel. So that's interesting. I'd like to shift a little bit to mental health. Governor Evers, using his veto pen, redirected funds from a mental health crisis center in the Northwoods to an existing crisis center in Madison. So currently, the closest crisis center for North Central Wisconsin residents is Oshkosh. That's up to 8 hours away for some rural communities with a pretty desperate need for mental health care. So why do you think this money, you know, doesn't go to the Northwoods? What's keeping it from funneling to our district here?
I can answer first. So here is what happened. In 2017, 2018, the Assembly passed and the Senate passed. It was signed into law. The requirement to close Lincoln Hills. And in that time, and, you know, I think it was if it wasn't unanimous, it was very close to being a unanimous vote. And the reason why we did that was there were, I think everyone knows, but the Lincoln Hills, Copper Lakes stories in the news were very disturbing on multiple fronts. And there were court cases and lawsuits. And just in general, there was tremendous concern about the staffing, that there weren't enough staff there, the staff safety, the student safety. It was a huge issue. So we voted almost unanimously, if not unanimously, to shut down Lincoln Hills on a timeline. This October, it was revealed that there is about $127 or $122 million short for Lincoln Hills, and there's not enough money for the county facilities across the state. Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center is going to take on multiple units in order to close Lincoln Hills and send those students down there for treatment. And if we want to close Lincoln Hills, then we have a statutory obligation to fund the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in order to have those kids go somewhere. And that's just a frank reality. So I understand that some politicians might want to use a fun political talking point that, you know, let's pit regions of the state against each other and say that the governor did one thing. But in reality, we all voted to shut down Lincoln Hills, and we all voted to make sure that there was a place for them. And this could have been done through the budget, but it wasn't. And so I'm very concerned. I want to make sure that the students at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes have every chance for success and every opportunity in terms of treatment. but there has to be a place for them, and the counties aren't ready to take them yet, and the places where the counties are trying to host them locally, those are also in dispute. So we clearly need to work together. I would urge my colleagues not to play politics on this issue. No one should ever play politics on mental health, and that's why the governor vetoed it, so that $15 million could go to the expansion of Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center so we could take those students from Lincoln Hills.
So what about adult mental health? I mean, what are some measures being considered that would expand access to mental health care in Wisconsin generally? For adults, it's a big issue as well. There are large demonstrated shortages of mental health care providers, especially in rural areas. What do you think that the state can do? Is there anything coming up the pike? Or do you have ideas of things that could happen to address those issues?
Well, I think telehealth will be big. I know when you talked about some of the, you know, the vetoes of the money going down to Mendota instead of going up to the Northwoods, it just kind of follows a pattern that a lot of my constituents are a little concerned about. You know, mental health is big. You know, the telehealth, the reimbursement rate for Medicaid that was also vetoed, and some of the others when it comes to mental health. But it seems like things that are hopefully coming to the north suddenly either get vetoed or shifted away. And not only in mental health, but we came out through the budget and put 62 ADAs up in the northern counties because of our overflowing courts, and including Wausau, which Marathon County, I was able to work through the budget. They asked for, you know, they're really understaffed. They asked for 4.5. Right now the county was paying for 2.5. And the state decided, well, we're not going to give you the 4.5. We'll just pay for your 2.5 and leave it at that. Well, we you know, because he vetoed it out. He cut it from 62 to 34. He sent a DA that we were supposed to get after the new revised thing down to Milwaukee County. Milwaukee County and Dane County are getting the ADAs. We have 60% of the workforce needed to handle the load we have in Marathon County. Milwaukee, 115%. Mm-hmm. Dane, 82%. They also have law schools with students that work there free, mm-hmm. Okay? And, you know, I just think the decisions there, it seems to be, at least my constituents, a lot of it is going south, kind of like the days when I was on the radio when Governor Doyle was here. A lot of people said, what about the north? And it seems like it's shifting back to that way again.
The DA issue is one that has been brought up here recently in Marathon County. Yes, the state voted to fund 3.5 positions.
4.5.
Oh.
Out of our budget. And
okay.
He cut it.
And then the net gain for Marathon County was only 1. Because
right.
Then the,
well,
the county.
Well, they're also funding 2.5.
So, but not anymore. So the county has pulled funding for the 2.5 now, is saying we're not going to fund that anymore because we think that is a state mandate.
Well, no. What happened was that the state agreed that they would now, instead of having the county fund the 2.5, part of the deal that the governor and his budget and his veto with the state would cover the 2.5, so no longer county. And that was going to be that, which is zero gain. We put passed in our budget that not only pay for the 2.5, but add 2 more. To go
okay.
To 4.5. And then the governor came in and said, no, you're going back to 2.5. We came back and I talked with the state prosecutors as well as the Department of Administration, and they raised it to 3.5. And that's where we were. They were trying in the budget to get it back to 4.5 for the county, yeah.
I understand what you're saying. Yes, the process was different.
And it's things like that that, you know, that I think the whole situation that comes down with the legislature is trust. And I just don't think we trust each other.
I agree. I think when people play politics and try to dunk on the governor instead of actually working together on things like passing legislation to fund 5 emergency regional stabilization centers for people with mental health, I think it's frustrating. I want to point out that the governor actually already directed the Department of Health Services to increase the Medicaid reimbursement. So it's not that that isn't already happening. I just think it's unnecessary to have veto override votes on things that are already happening on the ground with our state agencies. There's a bipartisan bill out there by Representative Spiros and Senator Schachner that I would encourage everyone to support. And that would, you mentioned earlier that everyone has to go to Winnebago. So for some people, they're driving 11 hours round trip if they're going to Mendota or Winnebago. This bill would actually create regional crisis stabilization centers across the state so that there's geographic parity and everyone would have a similar drive time. And I think that those efforts are the kind of thing that we should be working together on. What frustrates me when it comes to the legislature is it can be easy to say, well, this guy did this and this guy didn't do that. But what's more difficult is coming together on issues that our constituents demand without playing those politics. And I would just encourage everyone to do that, because I hear every day that we need to increase access to mental health. And I think the work that we did on suicide prevention in the assembly this fall was really the right track for us. And I hope that the Senate takes it up. But I think divided government has presented challenges that, you know, it can be hard sometimes when people have had power in all three, you know, the Senate, Assembly, Governor, to understand that now we have to work together in a way that maybe hasn't happened before. But it does come down to opening up communication.
Suicide is a huge problem in our state and the region. The state suicide rate rose 40% between 2000 and 2017. This according to a Department of Health Services report that was completed this year. So there's a task force that studied ways to prevent suicides in Wisconsin. They're recommending creating a statewide suicide prevention program with a director who would oversee that effort. Do you know where that stands now?
Go ahead, Katrina. I think it's in the Senate.
Yeah, the Assembly passed all of the suicide prevention bills from the task force, and I was proud to co-sponsor, I think, most, if not all of them. And the Senate has to take those up, just like they need to take up the homelessness bills. And so those bills will create new staff positions at the Department of Health Services, new coordinators, people to help on the front lines of mental health care, and even ways to educate people, whether it's students on their ID card, having a phone number to call if they're thinking about suicide or having suicidal ideation. There's simple steps that we can take that the Assembly has already passed, and I'm hopeful that we can get those bills signed into law.
You're both on the Assembly Committee on Workforce Development. Just briefly, what exactly does that committee do? What does that entail?
We get a lot of ideas, legislation coming up to enhance our workforce, enhance industry, manufacturing, apprenticeships, things that will somehow elevate not only our people and business, but also the opportunity for the worker to get the training needed and to be able to be qualified and reach out for those type of jobs. So we just kind of not only, work for new industry, but also for the opportunity to make sure that we have a workforce that's ready to step in there.
And Pat, you mentioned homelessness earlier, and there are a number of proposals in this committee that attempt to address homelessness in certain ways. So what is this committee's connection to homelessness and that issue?
Workforce development?
Mm-hmm.
It would probably go back to the there's opportunities through possibly fast forward, through the technical schools. Even we've had some individuals in our community come in with day worker ideas, similar to what City of Denver has done and Albuquerque has done, things that will work with the community that maybe emotionally they can't handle an 8-hour day or 5 days a week, but want a chance to be able to earn some money and get back into it. You know, that's why I always say if they have a roof over their head first, then we'll work on the issues that might be challenging them. So those are some of the workforce development ideas that will help in that area in particular.
All right. Thanks for explaining that connection. We do need to take a break. Republican State Representative Pat Snyder of Schofield and Democratic State Representative Katrina Shanklin of Stevens Point are in the studio today on Route 51 as we continue our legislative roundup discussing state legislation that impacts residents in our region. Your questions for our guests are most welcome. Join the conversation at 800-780-9742. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point and Republican State Representative Pat Snyder of Schofield are our guests today. As we continue our local legislative roundup, we'd love to hear from you, too. The number to call is 800-780-9742. Pat, you are vice chair of the Committee on Children and Families?
Chair.
Oh, you are chair.
Chairman,
excuse me. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you for the correction.
My ranking member is Representative Subic.
Okay. One of the proposals that caught my eye is one relating to storage of a firearm in a residence if a child is present and providing a penalty for not complying. What does that all entail, and where does that stand?
Well, that didn't come through my committee.
Oh, I thought it did. Excuse
no,
me.
Okay. No, that's okay. Mm-hmm. But I think that as a responsible parent, hopefully, you know, they take care of things like that. I know my son has a safe, you know, for his guns with his little toddler that's running around. But if it's part of the suicide task force and it passed unanimously, then I think it's got good bipartisan support.
Yeah. I know that gun rights are a contentious issue.
I heard that, yes.
Obviously, a sharp divide along party lines. Do you, either of you see any common ground and any room for movement on any of these issues?
I do. I'm an optimist, but I want to say I don't think it should be a partisan issue, and I haven't seen this as partisan. I think legislators from certain parts of the state hear more from one group of people than another, depending on how many people hunt. So I represent a district that, you know, overwhelmingly hunts, and I'm proud of that. I personally hunt. I think it's a great thing, and we need to understand that gun rights are a huge part of our culture in Wisconsin when it comes to hunting. And I also think we need to understand that when legislators hear from their constituents who, you know, there was another shooting recently in Milwaukee where a small child died and was just caught in the crossfire, like, they are representing their constituents too when they hear those stories. And we need to be able to talk and, more importantly, listen. And that means sitting down and recognizing that this isn't a zero-sum game. We can have gun rights and the right to hunt in Wisconsin while also protecting public safety. And I think when you talk to law enforcement about this, when you talk to folks who work in, you know, the courts, who talk about, you know, getting guns out of the hands of dangerous criminals, I think everyone can agree with those things. And so I've always said on the assembly floor when we have these debates, it isn't us versus them. It isn't one versus the other. We can have both. We can have public safety and the right to hunt and own a gun. We need to be more thoughtful about the process instead of making it so political and so ripe for attack. And that's the piece that I want to implore everyone to be a part of, is how can we work together to find thoughtful and meaningful solutions while respecting everyone's viewpoints on this issue.
Pat, what do you think? I mean, where is there some room for common ground and discussion?
Well, you know, there's always room for common ground if it you know, makes sure it preserves the individual's rights of the Second Amendment. You know, when the two bills that came up that the governor wanted us to review, just my district, my we took in emails and calls, and only my district people, because a lot of times you get these callers from all over the country and the state calling in saying, but 85% were against those particular bills, not against anything else. We go through a process of five different background checks for handguns now. And when it comes to the red flag laws, they just were very worried about the due process of everything, of an individual. I mean, it's like the no-fly list. You get on it, well, how do you get on, and then how do you get off? And I know it was, you know, clarified 14 days and all this other stuff, but, you know, there's other ways of doing that. They weren't satisfied with something of that nature. So these particular bills I could not support. Doesn't mean I wouldn't support looking at other ideas and other bills. But, you know, one of the things you do the research on is you find out that a lot of times these felons in Milwaukee area that shoot somebody, they have a rap sheet. How are they getting these guns? And when they have the gun, why aren't they sent right back to jail? Why are they put on issued bail money and back out for their court hearing? I mean, that's a felony to have a firearm if you're a felon. And, you know, they get it. And if a store sells it to them, they should be prosecuted. So, you know, we have to right now make sure that we enforce the laws that are on the books and make sure that it's not some of the deal-making process. Like if you do this, we'll drop the gun charge, something of that nature. It has to stay in force so that they know it's there. But I just think that, the mental health issue, I think there's things out there that can be done now with injunctions. And I just want to be able to look at those things a little bit more.
Certainly we could have an entire program on this. But one thing you brought up was public opinion. And here's a question. I mean, just generally, as a state representative, how do you gauge public opinion? And how do you assess that feedback from your constituents? And how does that play a role in the decisions you make?
Usually, there's only been two issues where I would say I was overwhelmed this session so far, that we had overwhelming pushback. One was the guns, mm-hmm. and the other one, believe it or not, was the anti-vax bill. The taking away the parental choice.
I believe that we had a program on.
I got
on that,
deluged on that one too. Mm-hmm. So those are the two, and that's you gauge that a lot. And you talk to, when it depends on the bill, if it's dealing with business, and you talk with community. That's why I have the opportunity for folks once a month. I try to meet in district. If they have questions, they can email me. I have a weekly e-newsletter, and a lot of folks do contact me and give me their opinion. And then I call them back and talk it over with them. And it's amazing. I know Katrina probably gets the same thing when you call back. I never thought I was going to hear from you. Mm-hmm. I'm so surprised you called me. So
to take that personal time.
Personal time, right.
Katrina, what about you? I mean, how do you assess feedback from constituents, and how does that play a role in the decisions that you make and the bills that you co-sponsor?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, I try really hard to focus on the issues that are most important to folks in my district. So clean water is a huge issue, and that's why I'm vice chair of the Speaker's Task Force on Water Quality and work so hard on getting everyone clean water. I also recognize that there are going to be times when my constituents and I disagree, and that is a normal and healthy part of the process. And I think we need to stop shying away from having real conversations with people who disagree with us and actually listen. And what I've learned is, whether it's the controversial issues or just when there's a misunderstanding or miscommunication about what a bill does versus what a bill does not do, it's really important that we have those healthy and robust dialogues with people. Most of the time, people will appreciate an explanation even if they disagree. And I always say, you have a right to disagree with me, and I want you to feel comfortable disagreeing with me. That's great. I think that's a healthy part of our democracy. But what I worry about is when, we have people who say, well, I don't agree with you 100% of the time, therefore you're wrong all the time. It's like, well, we should all have the ability mm-hmm. to disagree with each other but still find common ground, whether it's Republicans and Democrats trying to work together in the Capitol, or whether it's just community members who might agree on one issue and disagree on another. And on an issue like, gun rights and public safety, I do believe the only way we're going to be able to forge common ground is by sitting down and listening and exploring ways to work together. And I'd ask my colleagues, if you're a no on every bill that's been presented so far, will you please address this issue by introducing your own legislation? It really is that simple. We've got to start somewhere. And I think, there are a couple bipartisan proposals I've put my name on over the past few years related to this issue, like cracking down on straw purchasing, where people are illegally buying guns through other folks. And, they need to be getting criminal charges for that, and making sure that domestic abusers don't have access to guns, which there's a bipartisan bill right now that I think we passed in the assembly last session that was reintroduced. So there are ways to work together, but you have to be willing to listen, and you have to be willing to understand that not everyone's going to agree with you, and that's a good thing. It's good to have diversity of thought and opinion, and we can all learn something from each other.
You both have mentioned some frustration with the fact that it sometimes takes so long to get these issues to the forefront, that you work hard on these bills and then they don't come up for a hearing, or there's no action on it. And specifically in this last session, Democratic Assembly Leader Gordon Hintz had issued a statement just about a week ago criticizing what he called inaction in the most recent session. He cited some examples, which he says has widespread public support: Medicaid expansion, universal background checks, nonpartisan redistricting, medical marijuana, which we've already discussed, closing the dark store loophole, even has 79% public support, with 22 Democrats and 19 Republicans co-sponsoring that particular bill. So with that much public support and so much discussion, what will it take for these issues to actually reach the assembly floor come January?
Well, the issues you just brought up, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. The dark store one, we came close, and that has me scratching my head a little bit more to work on that. Some of the others we debated about in the spring and things to that. Again, it comes down to the trust factor. I don't think that our leadership trusts everything the governor might do, and the governor probably doesn't trust everything that we're going to do. So I don't know how we somehow get that trust factor where, you know, I know that a colleague of mine in the Senate wants to work on putting the 17-year-old juveniles, or, you know, back in the juvenile system. But he's worried about, you know, since there'll be an appropriation, that the governor, is, instead of saying you're 17-year-old and a juvenile unless you commit murder or, you know, rape, that he'll cross out murder or rape. And so that's the trust factor there, that they're worried that he'll change the legislation so they won't move forward on it. And it's just maybe going to take a little more time to meet with the governor and try to have that bond or that trust before you maybe move forward on a bill to make sure it happens. And hopefully maybe that will happen.
And I think, you know, I would challenge anyone who has trust issues to invite people to sit down and talk with them. So I work with, you know, I'm vice chair of a task force where the Republican is chair, Democrat's a vice chair, and we sit down every single week and talk for an hour. And you would not believe how much you can get done when you sit down and talk every single week with the same colleague and build trust and show that you are a person of your word. And so if there are trust issues between the legislature and the governor, I want to say it's incumbent on the speaker and the majority leader to sit down with the governor and vice versa. And I personally take my duty very seriously to not just introduce bills, but pass them and get them signed into law. I know, regardless of party, our constituents don't just want but demand that we work on behalf of them. We listen to them. We represent their views and we be their voice in Madison. That's our mandate. And so I'm going to spend less time, you know, complaining about how things are in Madison. I try not to ever, because it's a privilege to be there, and actually focus my time on getting things done. And I do think the water quality bills that I've been working on with my colleagues will be passed and signed into law. And the other priorities like dark store, we're going to keep pushing. I think we should send letters asking for hearings. We should be pushing on that issue. I know our local government folks are, but it is on us to push hard and to be persistent. And that's just an unfortunate reality in divided government, but we all have to form better relationships, build trust, and be willing to work together.
I want to cover just a couple more issues, make sure that we touch on these things. A study from the Rural School and Community Trust shows that students in rural areas are still facing some inequity, and that the state spends more per student in rural and suburban districts, even though it typically costs a rural district more to serve each student. So why do these inequities in spending exist, and what solutions do you think would work to help ease that issue?
I know in the rural school districts, one of their major cost factors is transportation. That eats up a lot of – plus, when I was at CESA 9 back in October, since 2008, high school enrollment in the north has gone down 23%. Enrollment. And so, you know, you still need the buildings lit in the classrooms, you know, all that. And so – when you don't maybe have the students, you don't have the income, but you still have to operate. So it is an issue. It's a big issue. Neighboring states saw this decades ago and consolidated in a lot of different. Now, in the north, it'd be harder to do. But in the southern part of the state, geographically, southern part of the state, you could consolidate. Mm-hmm. And Minnesota and Iowa both did it. And, you know, if doing something like that, if you put, you know, I've had people come to me say, well, why couldn't it just be Wausau, D.C., Everest, one big district? Well, you know, that's turf wars and things of that nature. But I don't know if the state's ready for that. But there's things that I think, as Katrina has mentioned, we need to have discussions on.
I think that the Fair Funding for Our Future model, which then Superintendent of Public Instruction Evers introduced a few years back, would solve a lot of the problems. I mean, we do not have a predictable system of funding that our school districts can actually rely on right now, and it's a very inequitable formula. So, for example, high property value areas with high poverty just do not get the state aid that they need, and the Fair Funding for Our Future plan would guarantee a minimum amount of state aid to every student. And it would incorporate a poverty factor into the formula. It would change the formula so that rural and declining enrollment schools would actually get increased aid. And it would just help increase equity and parity across all school districts so that our rural schools would finally get their fair shake. And that's something that he's proposed many years in a row that we've had bills introduced as well on and haven't gotten hearing for. It's something I'll continue to push. I care very much about our local public schools and agree that the rural schools are not getting their piece of the pie, and we've got to do something about it.
One last question, very briefly. We're almost out of time, but what one piece of legislation that's upcoming do you think will have the biggest impact on your constituents? Like 30 seconds apiece.
Wow. I don't know if there's any particular legislation, but I'm meeting with Secretary Amundson in January. I think we have to somehow look at this child care, availability of child care and the quality of child care for our birth to 6 years old, reach out to the families that might be in crisis, but also make sure that these kids come into kindergarten on equal grounds, because that will solve a lot of problems down the line.
All right, Katrina?
We have communities across the state where 40% of folks can't even drink water out of their tap, and I am working on legislation to help not just get them clean water, but prevent future contamination. We've just got to do better for clean water in Wisconsin.
All right. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guest, Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point, and Republican State Representative Pat Snyder of Schofield. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Our on-air producer today is Joy Ratchkramer. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, you'll hear a special Thanksgiving Day program in place of Route 51. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Until then, we're heading out of town.